From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now, and there are more defiant words today from the North Korean leader. Kim Jong-un told North Korea's state-run media that there is no room for negotiations on his weapons program. The United States has confirmed that the missile launched yesterday from North Korea was that country's first test of an intercontinental ballistic missile, a missile that in theory could reach Alaska. In response, the U.S. and South Korea conducted their own ballistic missile exercises in the Sea of Japan. Jim Walsh is Here and Now's security analyst with the Security Studies Program at MIT. He's with us in the studio. And Jim, we've had a day now to process the details of this launch. The U.S. has confirmed that it was, in fact, a missile that could cross continents. Does that change at all the way that the White House can respond to this threat?
Well, it's a bit of a paradox, Peter. On the one hand, it's a big development. And on the other hand, nothing's really changed. I mean, the same policy options we had yesterday are the same policy options we have today. I would say this, though. The test, because it's really the most important demonstration of capabilities that the North Koreans have had so far to record, it sort of underlines the fact that we have a basic disconnect. And that policy disconnect is they can make improvements in missiles faster than we can impose sanctions that would somehow interfere with that. So we are losing that game. And we've been losing it for a while. And so while it's no surprise, it again highlights the fact that the strategy, as long as they can build faster than we can punish them, is not going to succeed, and may underline the need for negotiation as a way to try to suspend their nuclear and missile activity.
Well, exactly, except for the fact that today Kim Jong-un says negotiations over this weapons program are out of the question. Is that bluster? Is it really?
Well, if you know, there's no lack of bluster that comes from North Korea as from other capitals in the world. North Koreans have been saying privately in unofficial meetings, so-called track two meetings, their officials have told retired American officials and experts that they are prepared to negotiate. Kim himself said in 2015 that he would and then repeated that he would suspend missile tests if the U.S. suspended war games. Now, that sounds to me like an offer. Now, it's not the end of a final negotiation. It's the beginning, not the end. But that sounds like a proposal. So my own view is that all the parties need to come and sit down without precondition, without saying you have to do something first. Just sit and talk. And I think, you know, maybe we would get a freeze, which would certainly be an improvement over our current situation. But beyond that, the danger here is inadvertent war. Escalation, miscalculation, at least if you're talking to one another, you reduce that danger.
One of the parties at the table could be China, although President Trump today is going after China, tweeting that trade between North Korea and China grew almost 40% in the first quarter, essentially making the point that China is too involved with North Korea to be of any help here. Does the president have a point?
Well, yes and no. That general trade figures don't tell you much about that relationship. I mean, remember, there are a lot of hungry North Koreans who are probably getting rice as part of that exchange of trade. The real thing you want to keep your eye on are two different things. Coal exports by North Korea, has China acted on that, and also oil exports to the DPRK. It was reported that in their capital city, they had undertaken gasoline rationing in part because of Chinese actions. So I think the Chinese have taken some actions, but I think Mr. Trump may have a level of expectation that's just not attainable. The Chinese aren't going to squeeze them to the point of collapse. Because they don't want a failed nuclear weapon state on their border. So I think the Chinese have done some. They've done more than they've done in the past. Obviously, the president is dissatisfied, though.
Yeah. Yesterday, China and Russia asked both sides, talking about the U.S. and North Korea, to stop flexing their muscles over this, telling North Korea to stop the missile testing, telling the United States and South Korea to stop these military exercises. Immediately, it didn't work. What
because
about
each
that?
Side feels compelled to respond to show the other side that it won't back down. So when they have a missile test, what do? We have more exercises and a test to show them that we're not going to give up what we're doing either. So there. And back and forth it goes. So I think, though, that when the president arrives at the G20, he's going to hear from China, he's going to hear from Russia, and he's going to hear from South Korea, our treaty ally, that we have to have some negotiations. Because, frankly, that's the only thing that could stop this quickly, even if it's not a panacea. If they keep testing, then they're going to get better. And so how do you stop a test? One way is negotiations.
Has North Korea outmaneuvered the United States?
Well, that's a tough one. I mean, this is a problem president after president has found easier to kick down the road than to try to to solve because of all the risks involved. I mean, North Korea, let's face it, they have an advantage. They don't care about Kim doesn't care about his population. He only cares about keeping power. So if you sanction his population, what does he care? All he has to do is survive, and he is risk acceptant. He's willing to wave a gun around when most of the countries in the region are pretty, you know, fat and happy and are not interested in running huge risks. So that is a built-in advantage for him, and it is a difficult problem.
Here and now, security analyst Jim Walsh, thank you.
Thank you, Peter.
As tensions with North Korea rise, President Trump heads to Europe today for a meeting with leaders of the G20 in Germany. Headlining his itinerary are meetings with Russia's President Vladimir Putin and Chinese President Xi Jinping. As we heard, both China and Russia have asked the United States, South Korea, and North Korea to sign on to a de-escalation plan to try and cool things down. The Korean Peninsula and much more will be on the president's agenda this trip. Joining us now is NPR's White House correspondent Tamara Keith. Tamara, before the president gets to Germany for the G20, he's going to be in Poland. Why Poland first?
Well, Poland will welcome him warmly. That's part of it. And the other part of it is he's going to make a big speech where he lays out his vision for the future of the transatlantic relationship. And, you know, there are a lot of questions that came out of his first foreign trip, where he went to NATO headquarters and didn't endorse explicitly Article 5, which is the sort of mutual defense portion of the NATO charter. And after that, he said, oh, yeah, we do endorse it. His aides say that in this speech, he will endorse that sort of mutual defense idea. And Poland is a country that, you know, is looking for ways to be protected from Russia and the influence of Russia. So that's why he's going there. But the other reason he's going there is that, you know, President Trump has long argued that other countries need to pay their fair share, is how he describes it, put more money into sort of the global defense through NATO. And Poland is a country that is putting 2% of its GDP toward its own defense.
Okay, so he's highlighting Poland there. Then he moves on to Germany for the G20, made up of leaders of the world's greatest, largest economies. There will be lots of talk about economic issues on trade. Now, on Monday, the president tweeted, really great numbers on jobs and the economy. Are there?
The numbers are good, certainly. But in terms of job growth in the first 6 months of this year is slightly slower than it was in the first 6 months of last year or in the last 6 months of President Obama's term. President Trump also just this morning tweeted, and this is sort of a preview of how he's headed into that G20. He tweeted, the United States made some of the worst trade deals in world history. Why should we continue these deals with countries that do not help us? So that's sort of a shot to these countries that he's meeting with, that they can expect to hear a lot more of him talking about, you know, getting American cars into their markets and various other items like that.
Right. And he's tweeted a lot about China, among other countries, criticizing their trade with North Korea. How is the U.S.-China relationship, which seemed to start off on good footing, morphed?
Yeah, the president, I think, felt a good rapport with President Xi. And, you know, they had a meeting at Mar-a-Lago and it went well. And the president had this feeling that President Xi was going to be able to fix the North Korea problem. And it's not that simple. As with a lot of things, it's more complicated than at first it seemed. And so the president, through various tweets and comments, has made it clear that he's lost some faith there. He also has a lot of concerns about trade with China still, as he did during the campaign. But that's also a relationship that is a very big, important relationship for the United States. And so, you know, the president of the United States is going to continue to have to play ball there.
I wonder how you think President Trump is going to be received by the G20, given that he didn't make many friends, if any friends, by withdrawing from the Paris Climate Accord.
Right. And on his last foreign trip, there was a G7 meeting where the leaders of the other major world economies spent a lot of time trying to convince him not to pull out of the Paris Climate Accord. He went home and promptly pulled out. And so he heads into this G20 where this is a big, important issue for a lot of these countries. And there's a question of whether it's going to end up being sort of G19 versus one.
Then there's also, if that's not interesting and compelling enough, this rather insignificant meeting with Vladimir Putin coming up. What's on the two leaders' agenda?
Well, so the interesting thing about that is H.R. McMaster, the national security advisor, said that at least as of about a week ago when he was briefing reporters, the president had no set agenda for that meeting with Vladimir Putin. Well, you can be certain that Putin is coming in with an agenda for that meeting. Among other things, he wants an agreement to this de-escalation plan for the Korean Peninsula. But he also would love some sanctions relief. In particular, back in late December, the Obama administration booted a bunch of Russian diplomats out of two compounds in the U.S. Putin wants them to be able to get back in. But President Trump is in a rough spot when it comes to sanctions. Even if he wanted to lift sanctions, it would be tough because Congress, the Senate, has already passed a bill that would sort of bind his hands on that.
Thank you very much. NPR's White House correspondent Tamara Keith, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
What does it feel like to be face-to-face with a great white shark? Our next guest knows firsthand. Brian Scarry has spent more than 10,000 hours underwater taking pictures of the animals. He's a National Geographic photographer, and his new book is called Shark. Brian, thanks for joining me.
Great to be here, Peter.
Well, one of the differences between what you do and what other wildlife photographers do is that you have to get very close to the animals you're taking pictures of.
That's exactly right. I don't know that most people think about that, but as an underwater photographer, you know, I don't have the luxury that my terrestrial counterparts do, where you can use a 600 millimeter lens or maybe sit in a camouflage blind for a month waiting for some elusive animal. I have to get into the ocean. I'm limited by the air supply on my back and got to get real close.
How close?
Right on the lens, practically. You know, to get great pictures, particularly of animals like sharks, you need to be close. You know, the ocean acts as a giant filter. It refracts light, it reflects light, it scatters light. And I usually need to add a little light to bring back color and detail. So, you know, 3 feet is ideal between your camera and the subject, but sometimes even closer.
Well, and I ask that because you have to get close to animals that would terrify most people. There's a section in your book written by Eric Vance, and it's about great whites. And I want to read a little bit about it.
Sure.
He says that meeting one in the wild is nothing like you'd expect. At first glance, it's portly, bordering on fat like an overstuffed sausage. From the side, one of the world's greatest predators is little more than a slack-jawed buffoon. It's only when it turns to face you that you understand why it's the most feared animal on Earth.
Yeah.
Is that what it was like for you?
Well, that's a very interesting description. I spent time in the field with Eric, and I was sort of amused at that description. But at times, yeah, I think, you know, with the great white, that it is accurate. But he's absolutely right that when you're sort of nose to nose with an animal like this, or you see it sort of approaching you from that head-on view, you know, you have this primal sort of reaction, I think.
So how do you handle that? Are you always in a cage?
I'm only in a cage with great whites. At least that's my sort of protocol. There are people who do choose to swim with great whites without a cage, but so far I haven't seen that as a really good thing to do. But, but you know, it's really the only species. Everything else, makos, blue sharks, tiger sharks, whatever, I'm not in a cage. And that's because, number one, for photography, it's better to sort of be out there, you know, having more mobility and being able to move and get close. But it's also a testament to the animals that, you know, despite popular belief, they're really not nearly as bad as they've been portrayed.
Is there a time that you've been down there and you've felt in danger?
Well, there was a moment on an expedition. I did a 5-week expedition to a place called the Southern Line Islands, one of the most remote coral reef systems in the world in the central South Pacific. Also, like going back in time. So these coral reefs were probably like the rest of the world was hundreds of years ago, and they're very predator heavy, lots of sharks. I was diving one night at Millennium Atoll at sunset, and my assistant and I ended up being sort of surrounded by probably in excess of 60 gray reef sharks.
Wow.
And gray reef sharks are beautiful animals, but they can have a bit of an attitude, and they were, you know, aggressive. They sort of were coming in hot, as I say. And normally, if an animal does that, you can sort of bounce it with your camera a little bit, and they usually are deterred. But
you hit the shark with your camera.
Yeah, they'll come in and sort of bounce their nose off it. Mm-hmm. And if you push back a little bit, they usually deter. But in this case, they weren't doing that. The lead shark was doing like a 360 coming back in, and behind that was five, and behind that was another 10. And, you know, it wasn't a great situation.
So there's an alpha like in a pack of dogs?
It almost seemed that way. Mm-hmm. I don't know the science behind that, but that's how they were sort of behaving, kind of like I envision a wolf pack. Mm-hmm. But again, that is totally anomalous. That's not my usual experience, that, you know, one experience versus countless that were very benign and good.
When you're taking pictures underwater, what's it like to get perspective right? Because you're working in this very foreign backdrop where you probably don't have a lot of ways to reference size and scale, and yet that's a really important part of taking pictures of a shark.
That is so good, and rarely, I don't know, ever have I been asked that, but it's true. And I do talk about that in the book as well, that, you know, to the degree that I can do it, I want to show sharks within their world, within their habitat, whether it's a coral reef or a temperate zone or whatever it might be, a mangrove nursery where baby sharks might live. But I do think that context is very important to human understanding of these animals, to see them as something more than just this, you know, villainous shape up in the blue void. Sometimes it means having a person in the picture to give scale or a shark cage or some reference point that we can process in our brains and say, all right, that shark is about this big, and, you know, but it's an important part of the equation. And it helps frame the context of these animals and their world.
And conservation is actually a pretty big part of your book, especially near the end. And it's a little disturbing, actually, because you've taken images of people, I assume they're poachers of some kind, or hunters that are cutting the fins off of sharks. And I assume the bodies are also just sort of left on the beach to rot. The stat that you use is that industrial fishing is responsible for most of the 100 million shark deaths every year. 100 million. I mean, how is that even possible?
Yeah, it's hard to fathom, really, but it's not only possible, but it's been going on for a long time. Most researchers that I've talked to about this say that it could be a conservative number, that the number could be as high as 170 or 200 million, largely for their fins. Yeah.
Are we talking about, you know, soup in China or something?
That's exactly what we're talking about. Yeah, the shark fin soup trade. But they're also being harvested in many cases for low-cost sources of ingredients for cosmetics and many different products out there. But the fin trade is the biggest offender, according to everything that I know. Mm-hmm. And to your point about poaching, in many cases, no, it's completely legal what these mm-hmm. folks are doing. And, you know, countries sanction it. So a big part of my work is been to sort of show these animals as something far more than villains, as demons, as they've often been portrayed, to show that they're complex, that they have a personality, and that they are important to the health of the ocean. You know, if we can get to a point where we can see their magnificence, maybe we can move that dial away from killing them.
You write that the population of the oceanic white-tip shark, I had never even heard of that animal before, is down to 1% of its historic population. How endangered is that species, and is that the most endangered species?
First part of your question, it's extremely endangered. It's on the brink of extinction. This is an animal, the oceanic white-tip shark, which is a pelagic animal, lives out in the blue water, the deep water of the ocean, an animal that has to be especially efficient at hunting and good at what they do. As recently as the 1970s, this is an animal that was listed by scientific literature as the most abundant large animal on planet Earth, large meaning anything more than 100 pounds. So it went from the 1970s being the most abundant large animal on planet Earth to being on the verge of extinction today, mostly hunted for their fins, not unlike the passenger pigeon or what we did to the American bison, almost wiping that out. So it is critically endangered. It is on the verge. And that's a substantial loss in just a few decades. Is it the most endangered? I don't know the answer to that. I certainly think that there are probably others in that same category, but it is without question one of the most endangered, and I think that story speaks volumes.
It's fascinating because these animals have been on Earth for 450 million years.
Right.
They've survived five mass extinctions on this planet. And yet, generally speaking, now they're having trouble.
Yeah, that's right. And that's part of the story, you know, that they have been around so long. They've remained unchanged for millions of years, hundreds of millions of years, because they have evolved to be perfect for the environment in which they live. But yet these anthropogenic stresses that are occurring today, obviously the overfishing and the hunting, but habitat loss and pollution and plastics and all the other things that are happening in the ocean. The ocean's dying a death of a thousand cuts, and it's affecting sharks, but everything else.
But can you understand why people are afraid of them and why it might be hard to drum up sympathy for sharks? Because, you know, as we're children, we're taught, one of the first things we're taught is that they can bite through license plates and cans of paint. And you go to the beach, and when you're a kid, that's the first thing you're afraid of when you step into the water.
Well, absolutely. And this is the premise from which I started, knowing that, you know, I too, as a child, was taught those things and believed those things. But I've come to see a very different view of these animals. And I do think that we can respect predators in the ocean just like we do grizzly bears or tigers, lions, you know, all these wolves, whatever. We understand their magnificence. And I think what's been lost to a large extent with sharks is that complexity. We don't necessarily see them as a majestic creature the way we do a pack of wolves in Yellowstone, you know? But I think photography can serve that purpose, and it can help people to understand that a shark is not a shark is not a shark, that each species is different. They have unique biologies. They have unique morphologies. And if we can see them as something incredible, you know, that a mako shark can swim 60 miles an hour and is endothermic, it can generate heat in its body, and that the great whites off Cape Cod live to 70 years old, and they have these enigmatic patterns that we don't fully understand yet. Where do they go? What wisdom might they possess? And then again, you know, making that connection to a healthy ocean, our healthy lives, to humans, I think that's all part of the equation.
National Geographic photographer Brian Scarry, his new book of shark photography is called Shark. Brian, thank you for coming in.
My pleasure. Thank you, Peter.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Sunbasket. Sunbasket makes it easy to cook nutritionist-approved meals in your own kitchen with organic, non-GMO ingredients from farms and fishermen sent directly to your door. Choose from paleo, gluten-free, vegetarian, breakfast, and family options. You'll get pre-measured ingredients and easy-to-follow directions, and get dinner on the table in 30 minutes. It's healthy cooking designed to fit your busy lifestyle. And it's delicious. Here and Now listeners get their first three meals free at sunbasket.com/now.
A budget crisis in Illinois that's been boiling over for more than 2 years is a few steps closer to a resolution. Yesterday, during an unusual 4th of July session, state senators passed a bill that would end Illinois' record-setting budget impasse. But Governor Bruce Rauner vetoed that budget, and later in the day, the Senate voted to override the veto. The bill now goes to the House, and Tony Arnold, who covers state politics for WBEZ in Chicago, joins us now. Tony, a lot of whiplash going on at the state house. What was in that Senate bill that the governor couldn't support?
It wasn't just so much what was in it, but also what was not in it. One thing that was in it that he cannot support is a permanent income tax hike. So that people in Illinois would have 4.95% of their income go to the state of Illinois rather than 3.75%. What was not in it that he wanted in there, actually some issues that are not directly related to the budget, although he said that they would, because they would increase the economy or grow the economy around the state. Those are property tax freeze around the state, changes to workers' compensation, which he says would help businesses and business owners, and then also term limits, which gets to why this has been going on for 2 years. The term limits gets to the political fight that's been going on between the governor, who's a Republican, and the very longtime House Speaker Michael Madigan, who's a Democrat.
It is amazing. The last real official state budget that your state had expired July 1st, 2015. Last month, Governor Rauner comes in. He calls lawmakers back for a special session to figure out how to fix it. Some Republicans have broken rank with the governor. How frustrated are civilians, people in Illinois, that want lawmakers to finally figure this out if they can?
Well, they're so frustrated that they successfully put pressure on representatives to break from their party's leader to vote for this. 16 Republicans in all between the Senate and the House voted for this budget, even though the governor opposes it. And that's telling. A lot of those Republicans come from downstate Illinois, more rural parts of the state, where there's universities. And universities have not received money since January 1st this year. They've also been the subject of not having really steady funding from the state come through for 2 years while this impasse has been going on. And those universities, the local economies around them, have been begging the state for any kind of money. And that's what this budget would do, which is why the Republicans ended up voting yes.
If the veto override holds up, who wins politically?
Who wins if the veto override holds up? It would be, well, there would be a state budget for one. So I suppose anybody that relies on state government funding that has not been paid for several months, if not years, they would win because they'd start having a plan for how much money they'll be getting from the state of Illinois. There's social services that have contracts with the state, but the state hasn't paid for the work that was done according to those contracts because of this impasse. So I suppose they would win. Politically, who would win? It's a win for the Democratic House Speaker, Michael Madigan, since this is something that he's been saying, that it's an extreme position to not have a budget, and that's the governor's position, which is the extreme one.
All right, we still need to see what the House will do, so we'll keep an eye on this story. Tony Arnold, a state politics reporter at WBEZ in Chicago. Tony, thank you.
All right, thanks.
It's not a pretty picture at Instagram. The Federal Trade Commission has sent letters to 90 celebrities and marketers reminding them that there are strict regulations guiding advertising and that they may need to disclose their sponsored posts on social media sites. Media analyst John Carroll joins us in the studio now to talk about this latest effort to promote transparency. Welcome, John.
Hi, nice to be here.
Could you describe what the problem is here?
Okay, so there's a whole bunch of Instagram posts out there. Like, say Kim Kardashian bravely decides to go back to Paris. And so she's on the tarmac next to her private plane, and her Louis Vuitton luggage is there. She sends out a snapshot of that on Instagram. She very well may be getting paid to do that, but normally she wouldn't disclose that.
She wouldn't disclose it. So for starters, tell us what the government would require her to do. I mean, what's required of advertisers?
Right. So the FTC says any material connection between an advertiser and an endorser should be clearly and conspicuously disclosed. So that's true of the marketer and the endorser as well, most of whom are celebrities who are paid to promote particular products.
Such as Ms. Kardashian. Who else?
Right. Selena Gomez. A study just came out that said Selena Gomez gets $550,000 for an Instagram post. But she has 122 million followers on Instagram. Kim Kardashian gets $500,000. So these are prevalent and they're very lucrative, I'm sorry, lucrative.
Extremely lucrative for the
celebrities.
And by the way, is it any different from product placement in a movie? I mean, is it different because it's Instagram?
It's different because it's an ad that doesn't disclose it's an ad. So I think most people are savvy enough to know that when a can of Pepsi shows up on a TV show, they've paid for it to be there. But these are things where there is no indication in most cases that it's an ad at all.
Okay. So the Federal Trade Commission has sent a friendly reminder about the disclosure rules to so-called influencers. Who got the letters, and how bad is the problem?
Well, a whole bunch of brands got it, from Chanel to Adidas to Popeyes, and a number of celebrities, Sean Combs, I'm not sure what he's calling himself these days, Heidi Klum, Victoria Beckham, they all got letters. And basically the problem is that a study of 50 most popular influencers showed that 93% of their posts did not disclose that they were sponsored. Or if they did, it was buried in some thicket of hashtags.
The study also estimated that a top celebrity could be involved in an average of 58 sponsored posts a year, and only three of those would comply with the rules. Could you give us another example of how these posts work?
Sure. So here's an Instagram post from makeup maven Kylie Jenner. It shows a picture of her with a teacup and a package of Fit Tea, and the copy says, "Relaxing with a cup of at Fit Tea. Fitness isn't always easy, but these results are worth it," exclamation point. Hashtag FitLife, hashtag FitTea, hashtag FitSpo. So nowhere in there does it say it's an ad. But she probably got $400,000 for posting that.
So this is a $1 billion-a-year business on Instagram alone. Has the Federal Trade Commission had any success in lifting compliance?
Very limited success. Last year, they busted Lord & Taylor and Warner Brothers Home Entertainment for violating the guidelines. But really, most people think that unless they start going after the celebrities, the reality show stars, the sports figures, who are really at the heart of influence marketing, nothing much is going to change.
Yeah, but what about going after Instagram itself? Anything the platform itself can do?
It has introduced a new tool for marketers where they it would say paid partnership with and then a brand name up at the top of the post. But it's an opt-in situation. Marketers would have to choose to do that, and not many might have the incentive to do that.
Right, because this kind of advertising thrives on seeming not to be advertising. That's sort of the point.
Exactly. So the less it seems like advertising, the more genuine it might seem. One of the things that's interesting is these people don't necessarily do a lot of these posts because they don't want to clutter up their feeds too much because then it becomes really obvious.
All right. Thank you very much. John Carroll, media analyst for Here and Now and a communication professor at Boston University. We have a link to his Campaign Outsider blog at our website, hereandnow.org. Thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you.
Netflix rolled out yet another new original series this weekend. It's called Gypsy, and it tells the story of a psychologist who starts meddling in the lives of her patients.
Underneath the suits, behind closed doors, we're all ruled by the same desires. And those desires can be raw and dark and deeply shameful. The more you watch someone, the more you realize we are never really who we say we are.
That is creepy. And it's Oscar nominee Naomi Watts as Jean, the main character. The show has got high production values and great casting. Even so, critics are already calling Gypsy the worst new TV show of the summertime. How does this happen, Eric Deggans, NPR's TV critic? I don't understand how a show that has such an investment in the cast and obviously in production values can be so bad.
Yeah, boring, slow, obvious. I mean, that voiceover kind of summed it all up. You know, it's very enticing and sounds very interesting. But in the end, when you sort of think about what she said, of course we know that. People aren't what they say they are when they present themselves.
It doesn't take a psychologist to tell us
that. No, we don't need a highly paid psychologist to tell us that. So basically, this show is about a therapist who decides to spice up her very sort of constricted upper middle class life by meddling in the lives of her patients, by getting involved with the ex-girlfriend of a guy who's sort of dealing with a breakup, by befriending the daughter of a woman that she's counseling who has trouble with control issues and boundary issues, by finding these people who are sort of satellites and involved in the lives of the patients that she's counseling to sort of find out if they're really telling her the truth when they're in the therapist's office, and also to get a little thrill out of telling lies and presenting herself as a different person. That all sounds very interesting, which is why it's so surprising that it's so boring. She's married to this guy who's played by Billy Crudup. She starts a relationship outside of their marriage, and he begins to figure it out. And here's a conversation where they're on a date, and they start to talk about infidelity, and you get the sense that maybe he knows something's going on. Let's check it out.
Do you think I'd know if you were having an affair?
Well, I would never. I can't keep anything from you, so I think you're safe.
One look at your face and I'd know everything.
Yeah. What about me? Do you think I would know?
I think you'd probably pretend for a while, and then you'd have one conversation with me, and then just leave.
That's a very specific response.
And that is kind of a boring conversation about something that should be really interesting. And that is pretty much the problem of the show in a nutshell. I think they just got too much time. It's a 10-episode series. And frankly, if they had made a 2.5-hour movie, I think they could have done something that was really interesting and taught and compelling. But when you stretch it out over that many episodes, it's just not happening.
So some critics blame the streaming model of Netflix for the failure. But what about that idea that storylines would not be allowed to ramble if episodes were released week to week instead of all at once? What do you make of that?
I don't think the problem is that because they're dropping all the episodes at once, they don't feel any need to discipline their writing. I think the problem is that they took a story that should have been a two-hour movie and they made it into a series.
So it's not enjoyed critical success after its premiere anyway, but Gypsy does stand out for featuring female talent. It's created by and written by and largely produced, in fact, by women. It's got a female anti-hero as the lead role, Naomi Watts. Is there something to be said about that in the male-dominated world of TV?
For sure. First of all, Naomi Watts is sort of the bright spot of this show. If you're a fan of hers, you might enjoy the series just because it's a showcase role for her, and she does very well playing this woman who lives this life that she feels is suffocating her and is compelled to take these kinds of risks. What's interesting to me about this year is this feels like the year of the woman on television. We have a lot of series that feature complicated, often troubled women. Series like GLOW, which is another series on Netflix that premiered last week. Big Little Lies on HBO. Harlots, a great new series on Hulu. And Hulu also had The Handmaid's Tale, which was a great series. So we've had a lot of great series with great female characters that also involved women in executive producing and as creators. And so last year, we saw a lot of great roles for people of color. I think this year, we're seeing a lot of great roles and empowerment and agency for women in television. And it's brought us some great television, and it's too bad that Gypsy couldn't meet that mark.
NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, thanks a lot.
Always a pleasure.
A cholera outbreak in Yemen has killed more than 1,300 people since April. The World Health Organization says the country is facing the world's worst outbreak of the disease, and more than 300,000 people could be infected by the end of August. Health officials blame the disaster on the ongoing civil war there. Johannes Brewer is deputy head of delegation for the International Committee of the Red Cross, and he joins us now by Skype from Sana'a, the capital of Yemen. Johannes, welcome.
Hello.
I understand that you have witnessed nothing short of atrocious conditions there in Sana'a where you are. What have you seen inside the hospitals?
Well, at the beginning of the outbreak especially, things were pretty hairy inside the different hospitals. We saw up to four people per bed. We saw patients lying in hallways, children dying. You saw people with infusions in parking areas hooked to car windows because there were no room. We had different cases of relatives fighting for loved ones to get admittance to hospitals because they were sick and hospitals were overfull. It was a pretty difficult scene to digest.
Is it getting worse?
The cholera outbreak is getting worse for sure. At the moment, we're seeing more than 230,000 cases already. But at least the health system has somehow managed to ramp up its response, and slowly but surely the response is improving. We're seeing also a mortality rate that's decreasing at the moment of 0.6%. As opposed to more than 1% at the start of an outbreak.
You say the health systems are ramping up. How is that possible? Because we're reading that many of the hospitals have been destroyed. Many doctors are not getting paid. And this is a direct result of the war between Houthi rebels and the government that's been raging now for 2 years. Major basic infrastructure is falling apart.
That's right. Most people are working for free. Basically, in the health centers we support, we see immense dedication from healthcare professionals, people working with no salary for the last 10 months. So this basic generosity is what's keeping it afloat at the moment. It's, I would say, the last line that's stopping the whole system from collapsing. Some medical supplies are coming in. Ourselves, the Red Cross movement, as well as MSF, Medicine Sans Frontier, as well as WHO. It's still not enough, but at least the response is improving.
And what's caused this outbreak? Is it the fact that, for instance, sewers are now dysfunctional across the entire country?
It's a real combination of different factors. For one, yes, as you mentioned, the sewer stopped functioning in Sana'a 10 days before the outbreak started, the current outbreak. Across the country, we've seen sewer systems collapsing. We've seen water systems also collapsing, so people relying on different unsafe sources of water. We're also seeing garbage collection not being done in major urban centers. So this is also contributing.
The Saudi royal family has donated $67 million to help contain the outbreak. It's also responsible for the bombing campaign as it backs government troops against the rebels. How is that donation being perceived on the ground where you are?
The ICRC did not receive part of this donation to distribute, so I cannot comment on how it's being perceived on the ground. But as a humanitarian worker, all the contributions that we could receive at this moment would be useful. That said, we do believe that the solution to this outbreak is a political one.
How so?
The country is already on its knees, and it will continue to deteriorate even after this cholera outbreak, with a lot of systems already collapsing. If the war continues, the consequences will be even more dire.
And this is a country that you've been to many times. You say it's a country that you love. You're there not only in the midst of this cholera outbreak, you're also, as you say, sitting in the middle of a war that's killed 10,000 people. What are the conditions like just to live there in Sana'a?
Even in 2010, when I was living here, we used to have 24-hour electricity in most of the towns and cities in the country. There was running water. It was absolutely normal. And at the moment, what we have is maybe 2 hours of electricity every day or 2 days. It's a country that's definitely been pushed back a few decades in terms of development.
And I understand that you can even hear the airstrikes and the fighting going on from where you are sometimes. Are you concerned about your own health, your own safety?
No, not too concerned about our own safety, because the Red Cross is a protective emblem under the Geneva Convention. So our premises are all marked and notified to parties to the conflict. But that said, you do hear a lot of airstrikes relatively close by. You do sometimes see the smoke. You see the planes flying over. It is still a war zone.
Hmm. Johannes Brewer is deputy head of delegation for the International Committee of the Red Cross there in Sana'a, Yemen. Johannes, thank you and good luck.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.